This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. Cigars, classic cars, picturesque and idyllic holidays. These are some of the images commonly associated with Cuba. But like all countries, Cuba has been severely impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, with its economy shrinking around 11% last year, as tourism, its biggest economic sector, all but evaporated amid global lockdowns. Cuba also had to contend with a surge of COVID-19 infections in the middle of this year that it's just beginning to emerge from. So what is the path to recovery for this Caribbean island state? Well, joining me today to discuss this is His Excellency Florentino Batista Gonzalez, the Ambassador of Cuba to Malaysia. Ambassador Batista Gonzalez, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Shazana. It's a pleasure being here this morning.
This isn't your first rodeo in Malaysia, Ambassador. You served a posting here in the mid-2000s, and now you're back a decade later as the head of the Cuban mission. So I want to start with your observations of how Malaysians view Cuba, yeah? What are some of the misconceptions that Malaysians may have about Cuba that you're looking to address during your time here?
Well, that's an interesting question. I have never looked at it from the point of view of the misconceptions of Malaysians. I have always looked about the coincidences. And certainly, and to begin with, I'm very lucky to be here again. I consider myself a lucky diplomat coming to get twice to Malaysia, beautiful Malaysia. But 10 years ago, I would say that Malaysia was still, from the historical point of view, much closer to the events of the 1997 financial crisis. And at that time, some of the feelings that were created and some of the positions that actually put Malaysia and Cuba under the same path of national sovereignty and nationalistic development and defense of the national interests were much more visible. I'm not saying that they are weaker today, they are still there, but at that time they were much more visible. And on many of the international forum and many of the common causes that we shared from totally different perspective, we had at the end a fairly common position, and that made the relation indeed very strong. And the general perception of Malaysians at that time was that Cuba and Malaysia had many things in common and many positions in common, and we have all the different paths. The future was somehow tied together. 10 years later, that has not changed. But if I may say, it's a little bit less visible. There's been a generational change in Malaysia. There's been a generational change in the leadership, both in the corporate and the public sector here in Malaysia. But once you address the topics, you again find that the positions are there, they are common. And because basically, when you defend the national interests of Malaysia, you would find that your result is fairly much similar to the one that we will be doing on our own.
So interesting. Yeah. In that way, the principles that Malaysia and Cuba shares, there's a lot of similarity that binds us together. Although Malaysia and Cuba have established diplomatic relations since 1975, there doesn't seem to be much by way of economic and business ties between the two countries. And this is really in general. Trade relations between Malaysia and Latin America, I think overall, are just relatively small compared to other regions. But trade with Cuba in particular, for me, it was hard to verify. I found it hard to find data on the size of trade relations or, you know, key business corporations that we have. What do you think is hindering deeper economic ties between our two countries? Why are they still at this very small level?
Well, there are a couple of important factors for that. The first one is distance. The second one is the absence of regular shipping lines and to that part of the globe from Asia, especially from Malaysia. And I must say that because there's a lot of restrictions that Cuba has to face due to the U.S. sanction policy towards Cuba. Let's say if a vessel comes from Malaysia to Cuba right now, after it touches any Cuban port, cannot go to the U.S. for 6 months. So that is a major obstacle for shipping lines, and it's a major obstacle for trading in general, logistically speaking. Then you have financial restrictions for the type of banks you can use, for the type of monies that you can do remittances. So there are challenges to have a better trade or a normal trade relationship, if I may say, just for a normal one. We have the challenges. Then certainly these are two economies that are, they differ on their size, on their priorities, on their needs. The complementarity that must exist is not there that clearly, or at least not there in general senses. We have certain pockets or niches that can be very well used and could mean a total change in the relationship. But in general senses, we remain a country that import raw materials, some processed things. And from that point of view, Malaysia is not our main supplier. Mm-hmm. Although we have certain very specific things, let's say palm oil we buy from Malaysia and some others. But in general sense, there's no that complementarity.
Okay, that's interesting. And that's a very good explanation of why our trade relations maybe aren't bigger than what they are. But with that said, which sectors of the economy do you intend to prioritize in your push for closer cooperation with Malaysia?
If I may say where I see the biggest potential, I'm not without challenges, of course, but with the biggest potential is in the high-tech services, especially biotech and biomedical services. Why I say that? Because Malaysia has been investing heavily in that sector for the last 20 years, and I believe that we do have a complementarity in that sense. We have a lot of highly developed IP results on that research, which is proprietary from Cuba. And Malaysia has the facilities, the capital, and the market to develop many of the things. So I see there a complementarity. We have the research, we have the products up to a certain level, and we need a partner that can come up and take it to the last stage of it. The pandemic has only put a new dimension to it, in the case of COVID vaccines and in the case of all the products and treatment. This is the new dimension or the new urgency that the pandemic has brought about to this dimension. But certainly in general terms, that is an area that we can complement very well with Malaysia, and we can have a lot of things done and on high tech, on high in an industry that really can mean a difference for the trade balance between the two countries.
And we're going to explore more on Cuba's vaccine development in just a little bit. But I would like to ask you about how receptive you think the Malaysian government has been to push Malaysia-Cuba relations forward. And you alluded to this a little bit earlier, saying that changes of government, you know, passage of time, emphasis may be different from when it was before. Do you feel that from a foreign policy standpoint, Latin America and within that Cuba, it's not really a priority for Malaysia at the moment?
I would not be in a position to put a qualification on that, if it is much or less, because in this type of things, you cannot use the public perception as an actual key performance index on how the attention has been doing. Because you might see less articles in the newspaper, but you might see also that trade with some Latin American countries like Chile and Argentina has tripled or four doubled in the last decade. So numbers do not really reflect or not always reflect whatever is the reality in political perceptions or in diplomatic perceptions. I would say that indeed there's a lot to do with Latin America, and that Malaysia can gain a lot from prioritizing that part of the planet. Malaysia can play an important role in becoming a market, a transition point, a transshipment point also for Latin American countries. And there's much to be gained and certainly much more to be done.
Let's turn our attention to Cuba's presence in the region, because Cuba acceded to ASEAN's Treaty of Amity and Cooperation just last year in November. And Cuba's only the fifth Latin American country to formally partner with ASEAN. Compared to other parts of the world, Cuba is a relative latecomer to ASEAN partnerships. What does Cuba hope to gain from engaging with ASEAN overall? What synergies do you see?
Well, we are relatively late, but I would say not basically because we chose to come late. I mean, Cuba has had embassies in most ASEAN countries. Cuba is one of the very few countries that have embassies in most ASEAN member countries for more than 20 years. And certainly we have a long-standing interest in reaching a new platform for cooperation with the region itself. We have enjoyed excellent diplomatic relations bilaterally with most of the countries on the area, as mentioned Vietnam, as mentioned Laos, Cambodia, Indonesia, Malaysia. But as a bloc itself, as ASEAN, it's been a little bit lower down the line. I would say first, because ASEAN itself as a bloc took a longer time to start accepting observers, to start accepting partners for development, for different things. And certainly they did that according to the priorities they had at a certain point. So I'm not saying it's right or wrong, it's just how things evolve. But to us, to ASEAN, it's a partner of great importance in this part of the planet for trading, for investment, for technology. And also, if we were talking about the same opportunities that apply to Malaysia, applies also to ASEAN when it comes to biotech, biomedical. Some of the products and the things that we have developed are fairly much in need in this area. And there are quite few countries that have the capacity or the ability to partner and to bring it to a new level and to a new position that could be fairly much beneficial for the entire region.
I'm speaking to His Excellency Florentino Batista Gonzalez, the ambassador of Cuba to Malaysia. When we come back, how is Cuba handling the twin crises of healthcare and economy in the COVID-19 pandemic? Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Thanks for staying tuned to The Breakfast Grill. On the show with me today is His Excellency Florentino Batista Gonzalez, the ambassador of Cuba to Malaysia. Cuba dealt with an explosion of COVID-19 cases in the middle of this year. That's now trending downwards, in large part due to your vaccination campaign. Now, Cuba took a different route from most countries in developing its own homegrown vaccines rather than purchase them from abroad. But that has meant that your vaccine campaign started relatively late. How has this progressed and what is the update on vaccinations at the moment?
I would say that comparatively to other countries, it might have been a little bit delayed on time because we chose the path of building our own vaccines. And right now we have five vaccine candidates, two of them fully approved for use in the country, the other on different stages for different kind of uses. But we began, I would say, from March. It was a fairly large, it was called at that time clinical intervention because it was still as part of the phase 3 clinical trial, but it was on a large scale for intervention. And fully as a vaccination campaign with the full name, somewhere after May, it is speed up and started to gain momentum after that. But the most important thing that I want to point out is that even if we were on similar trend with the rest of the planet in August, September, in terms of infection and cases, right now we are less than 500 cases per day. Mm-hmm. Which is outstanding in terms of successful approach of the vaccine. Mm. The quality and the impact, you can only measure it now. Whatever doubt or whatever things we would need to be proven, numbers are proven it right now.
And Cuba has begun exporting vaccines, even though it hasn't yet received approval from the WHO. I believe Cuba has sent supplies to Venezuela and Vietnam. Why has Cuba chosen to do this? Wouldn't a lack of international approval hinder efforts to sell the vaccine?
Indeed, the lack of WHO might hinder that possibility, but it has never been the first priority for us actually to sell the vaccine. It was more a public health concern, and that comes second. The actual commercial part of it comes second, and that's why we try to help countries that were in a very difficult situation of trying to get their own vaccines. The so-called vaccine equity and vaccine diplomacy have been terms that have been coined during the last few months. I don't actually like them that much, but still, vaccine equity is fairly much a fact countries that had even fairly large resources to acquire them, they were totally excluded from the distribution channels on the priority line. They were left behind on the line. And those were the countries that we tried to help if we had a good relation with them. And even, let's say, with Iran, it was a country that they did a clinical trial phase three and over there just to prove the safety and efficacy and everything from the vaccine. And they jumped straight to production. Once they tested and they saw it was okay, they felt that they didn't need to wait for WHO approval. Mm-hmm. They had their own data. They have their own technical assessment of the efficacy of the vaccine and the quality. So they jumped straight to production and to vaccination campaigns. In the case of Vietnam and Venezuela, we shared whatever information we had on the technical information with the vaccines that was sufficient to them, and they decided to go for the vaccines. We have submitted to WHO our files, and eventually it would come down, and that would mean a different commercial approach. But once again, commercial approach is only that. It's commercial. It's not the healthcare approach.
Okay. You mentioned the U.S. embargo earlier in our conversation, which has been in place for many decades and is commonly cited as a reason for Cuba's depressed economy. But has the embargo become a convenient villain for Cuba? Despite the embargo, Cuba does have relations with other countries, with the EU, with China. Can economic stagnation be pinned on U.S. sanctions alone?
I mean, you use the word alone. I would never use the word alone. Nothing is alone to be blamed for everything in life. But I would say that mostly we could blame on many of the limitations that do that. Let's say you talk about Europe. You go right now to Europe to buy anything for Cuba in Germany. And it's going to be very difficult to find a bank that would take your money. Then anything that you're going to buy, if it has more than 10% component of US technology, cannot be sold to Cuba. And then if you, after you buy, you paid it, let's say you found it, whatever thing you are going to look, it has no U.S. component, no U.S. property, no U.S. executive on the board of that company, it reaches that point, then you go and find a shipping line, and you would see that the company will tell you, but I cannot afford just to send one ship down to Cuba and cannot use it for 6 months later and everywhere in the U.S. So all that combined effects ends up with a minimum capacity that indeed legally and technically and theoretically we can go and do business in anywhere in this planet, but in practical terms, that is not the case. So I would not say it's the only, but I would say it's the most important problem for the Cuban economy.
Sticking to Cuba-US relations, what are your thoughts on the Biden administration's strategy towards Cuba? Will President Joe Biden take the more hardline stance adopted by former President Trump, or will he be more engaging as President Obama was during his term?
Obama opening to Cuba was hugely popular within the U.S. political establishment, both sides of the aisle, both Republican and Democrat. And indeed, it proved to be an invigorating factor in the relation. In less than 4 years, more than 20 different agreements were signed. All kind of American companies were trying to set establishment in Cuba, to do business, to have a presence. Cruise lines companies were flooding Havana ports with close to 600,000 U.S. visitors per year. So we are talking about a total new relation. It was not still a normal relation because the embargo was there for most of the factors, but it was a new way of doing things. And certainly it's not that I said it. President Biden made a presidential campaign stating openly that if he would be elected, he would do a swift return to Obama's era's policy. Certainly there was the hopes and many of the quarters were expecting that to happen soon. Of course, the people who were supporting the other side, the Trump side, were against it. There's a policy that proved to be successful within the U.S., popular, and that managed to bring about a new type of relation to the two countries. And that's the one we are aiming for. We cannot move from where we are. I mean, we're an island. We live next to the U.S., It's our neighbor. We don't planning to move the island anywhere else. So the only future is that we are able to build a normal and civilized relation as two neighbors with differences, probably on very few things we would ever agree. But we can behave respectfully and we can build a normal relationship. It's the only way forward.
Ambassador, Cuba made international headlines in July this year when Cuban protesters took to the streets over the dire economic situation. These were described as some of the largest demonstrations that have been seen in years. But another protest that was planned for this month was reportedly suppressed by the Cuban government. Is the government denying the hardships faced by the people?
No, on the contrary. This is something undeniable. Whatever grievances they were about, and they were truthful, they were genuine, and they were there. And you can look at the graphs. Life cannot lie. You look at the July 11th, you check on the graphs of the pandemic, on the situation, on the economic situation in Cuba during those months. And certainly, it was probably one of the hardest periods that we have lived in the last 10 years. So certainly, there were probably good reasons for a good number of people to show and express their grievances in whatever way they thought it was fit. That is one thing, and not only cannot be denied, it's that must be addressed and accepted. Whatever things are being put forward on those must be addressed by the government and about all the political institutions in Cuba and by all factors. What we have rejected on that case and what we are rejecting in any case is foreign interference for that. It's been manipulated, funded, organized, and used on platforms coming from abroad to instigate something that is not genuine. And technically speaking, it was proven that most of the things that happened in the social networks during those days were coming from outside Cuba, manipulating algorithms, creating fake accounts, using high-tech resources to prove and to show something that was not actually existing. And that is something we totally reject. Interference is not acceptable.
How do you distinguish between what is seen as interference and what is seen as organic expression from the Cuban public then? It seems quite easy for the government to say anything that disagrees with the government is foreign interference.
It might seem easy to foreign observers, but it's not that easy. And Cubans know that very clearly. Cubans within Cuba knows that very clearly and can detect immediately what is one to the other. I would say that Cuban political dissent in any way has been fairly much active, alive and present in Cuban life for the last, I don't know, since I remembered. Do you only need to go to a theater play in Cuba to assess the level of political dissent that you can find openly and publicly in the street? You stand in any corner, and we sometimes joke when we say that you have two Cubans and you have three opinions, because Cubans are really opinionated, but whoever has been to Cuba can assess that public dissent and public political public dissent is quite alive and well in Cuba.
Ambassador, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I've been speaking to His Excellency Florentino Batista Gonzalez, the Ambassador of Cuba to Malaysia. This has been The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.